Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
Although I don't own any myself, I've been a little obsessed by the crazy swings in value of the digital currency Bitcoin. I know it was created, at least in part, to wrest control of the money supply from central banks, which by definition serve the interests of the governments that control them. But I'm not going to lie to you, I've been a little fuzzy on the meaning of blockchain. That's the technology that underpins digital currency, but has implications for many other aspects of modern life and cybersecurity. So I was super excited to find the primer in this month's Scientific American. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The January issue of the magazine features a special report that dives into the complexities of the modern financial system and how the transparency of digital currency could reduce risk, but only if it is used responsibly. Jen Schwartz is senior features editor at Scientific American, and she joins us now from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about the future of money. Jen, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the value of Bitcoin, as we all know, has been on a wild ride the past few weeks. We're hearing how regulators are trying to figure out what to do about that. But right off the top in this series of reports, you stress that Bitcoin is just the beginning. So tell us a little bit about the technology that makes cryptocurrency possible.
Sure. So when we wanted to put this big future of money package together, the idea was that we would look at Bitcoin because it was such an obvious place to start. But it quickly became very clear that there's a much bigger world beyond Bitcoin. So, you know, the technology that is underneath Bitcoin really has so many fascinating applications. And that's where we really started to explore about how that touches the world of finance, but also beyond that, and can be used to transact any type of data.
The modern financial system is described here as being dangerously complex. I mean, it's always been pretty complex. Why is it more dangerous now than it was half a century ago?
That's a great question. And, you know, there's so much more that we have to track and trade. And when you look at the complexity of a lot of the way that our systems work now, if you look at big pieces of policy, you know, one example that came up was like any sort of health bill. How is that going to get funded? There are so many players in place and, you know, citizens and banks and companies and private and public. And it really just gets, we have an incredible amount of data. So now that we have big data, and we have a surging population and we have all sorts of new technology, how do you actually track the monetary circuit? How do you see risk in a more clear way? These are some of the ways that the complexity is becoming or has become impossible to really model in a level of detail that makes us able to really see where things can go wrong.
The thinking here is that one benefit of digital currencies is that they allow for really sophisticated simulations of different activities, right? Where you mentioned, you know, the healthcare system or whatever. Why is this easier to do with digital currency than with, say, dollars or euros or yen, which are often traded digitally?
That's a really good question, and it's a big confusion that a lot of people have. So cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin, that is one use for blockchain technology. But if you think of blockchain technology as just a tool that can be used to transact or keep track of really any type of data, then you can start to see how if you put data on a blockchain, if you use it to hold and trade and just sort of have this clarity of how data is being moved around in a secure way, you can start to see that any data can be used and stored and exchanged on a blockchain. So it's not so much that a cryptocurrency in every situation is being used to power, if you will, these new types of networks. It's that the technology itself goes beyond just forms of currency.
All right, so let's talk about this data structure called blockchain, which really is at the heart of this package and of this entire issue. What exactly is a blockchain?
So in its simplest form, a blockchain is just a new type of digital infrastructure, if you will. So it functions as a distributed ledger of transactions. And maybe that's a term that people sometimes hear, is this distributed ledger. So we know what a ledger is. But in this case, the technology is that it gets distributed among lots of different entities, people, computers, and that way it isn't controlled by a central authority, but in effect, it is validated and operated by a distributed network. So that is one definition of blockchain. But it's important to realize that, you know, blockchain technology isn't Bitcoin. So really, blockchain can be used and manipulated and tweaked and designed for all sorts of uses. So if you hear that term, it really doesn't mean any one particular thing. Depending on how you engineer it, it can mean all sorts of different things and have all kinds of different purposes.
Does blockchain have intrinsic value?
Blockchain itself is just a tool. It is really just a technology. It is basically, a bunch of code. It's using a mathematical, consensus mechanism rather than humans overseeing how all of this information stays secure and is transacted. So blockchain itself doesn't have value. It's the fact that you can run a currency on the blockchain network, and the currency itself, we determine what the value of that might have. But it's an interesting point. Just because blockchain is in a name or it gets associated with something, doesn't imply or doesn't imbue it with any sort of automatic value.
Hmm. So when we hear about people mining for something like Bitcoin, which is just one of the digital currency technologies that that uses blockchain, are Bitcoin miners really just mining for blockchain formulas?
So if you're on the Bitcoin network and you have Bitcoin miners, so that is running on the Bitcoin blockchain. So what the miners do is that they are basically overseeing and maintaining the network. They are validating transactions. They are adding transactions to the blockchain of the Bitcoin network. So what the miners are computers, and the computers are being used to solve complex mathematical equations, and that's the sort of security in place. Now, so that's just using raw computing power. Of course, humans oversee, own these computers, and so that is where the sort of human-machine balance comes into play.
So I've got this 2009 Dell laptop just gathering dust at my house, but I can't really set that up and practically mine for Bitcoin, right?
No. You need special, special hardware. And in the beginning, when Bitcoin first started and it was sort of launched as this potential new alternative currency, the whole idea was that individual people the world over could be miners. You could buy the specific hardware and you could mine out of your living room. Many years later, now we're seeing that mining has been sort of clustered into these pools, because the more computing power you put towards solving these mathematical problems, the more likely you are to essentially solve the problems and win Bitcoin. And you get, Bitcoin, and that's the incentive of the mining structure, is that you get a little bit for solving the problem. So now there are all these clusters of mining pools, and it's very concentrated. And so what started out as a highly decentralized system is now becoming more centralized. And that's one of the problems that's occurring with the Bitcoin network.
What are the implications of the fact that China has mined something like 71% of the Bitcoin discovered so far?
So what that means is, in countries where there is low energy cost, there have been, humans see an incentive to set up these mining pools. So mining requires an incredible amount of energy, a lot of electricity. You have to run all of these computers, and to solve these problems, it takes a lot of power. So where energy is cheap, you get these clusters, these pools of miners. And basically what that means is, in China, If that's taken off there, it means that instead of the network being this truly globally distributed network, it means that there's a lot of intensive clustering, if you will, of who is operating the system. So the idea is that it's more secure the more distributed it is. But as we can see, it's becoming less distributed when you have these groups that are effectively controlling larger portions of the network.
Why is it that criminals have seemed to have been particularly interested in blockchain-based transactions?
It's a great question. You know, there's a lot of discussion about this. Is it really, should blockchain and cryptocurrencies really be so affiliated with illegal activity? Is that a fair assessment? Well, yes, it is. There's plenty of illegal activity that goes on these networks. And part of why it's attractive is because there is no central authority and there's no central intermediary. So you are transacting peer-to-peer, person-to-person. And of course, you're able to, this is a global digital network. You can send money and receive money anywhere in the world without, these, what were traditionally these big fees and sort of barriers to that. So that's why it became so attractive. And of course, there's, no regulation. But what's interesting is that part of what makes blockchain more transparent is that it really is traceable. Your identity isn't directly tied to your transactions. But if someone really wanted to figure out, what these transactions, who they were connected to, it is this permanent ledger. And so in some ways, and as we go forward and as this technology evolves, it is a more permanent record of transactions. So in some ways, it becomes less appealing for criminal activity. But again, until we really have regulation and more standardization in place, illegal activity is certainly going on.
So right now, central banks regulate capital creation, but private banks also play a role in creating money. So they're not entirely transparent. This is why we can't see an impending disaster like the mortgage crisis of a decade ago until it's too late. Why would digital currency make it easier to forecast a crisis like that?
Yeah, great question. So when you look at how the financial industry is basically researching and thinking about how they could use blockchain technology. The idea is that you could transact any data. You could, you could transact the US dollar or contracts or other sorts of, transactions and trades on blockchain technology. So if a bank was using blockchain technology or a government, the idea is that you would have this record and it would all interact with each other. So you might be able to build tools that are able to simulate all the possible outcomes. You would be able to see risk at a much higher level of clarity because you would be able to sort of play everything off of each other. It wouldn't be based on, historical averages or sort of guesstimates based on what's happened before. You would be able to sort of wrangle all of the data that we currently can't simulate at a level of detail that's really quite clear. Of course, it still requires creating tools to catch, any red flags or areas of high risk. And that all comes down to who is regulating and overseeing these systems. So there has to be still, again, blockchain is the tool and we can use it to make our systems more secure. But of course, we do have to use it for that purpose.
Yeah, and it's only as good as the algorithms we build to make these predictions.
Exactly.
Okay. My guest is Jen Schwartz, senior features editor at Scientific American. The January issue of the magazine features a special report on the future of money. If you'd like to be part of this conversation about blockchain and what it does, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email us at think@kera.org, or of course you can find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jen Schwartz, who is Senior Features Editor at Scientific American, which features in its January issue a special report on the future of money. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Okay, Jen, when we say that blockchain makes things like digital currency more efficient than a currency like the dollar, what form does that efficiency take?
So that's a great question, and that's what a lot of people are debating right now. The idea is that if you have fewer intermediaries and you don't have all of these sort of human interference in currency, then you would be able to just trade person to person, and you would be able to strip out fees, you would be able to strip out some greed and exploitive practices, and that was sort of the idea of it. But as we're seeing Bitcoin grow, and as we're seeing more interest from academia and finance and other industries about how these technologies might get incorporated into traditional systems, we're seeing that maybe it's not as efficient as, you know, the original adopters and developers thought it would be. So the idea is that it brings in certain forms of efficiencies, like transparency, like being able to truly track where everything is moving. But in other ways, as we're seeing, for example, with the energy problem of how energy intensive it is, that certainly isn't very efficient. And the speed and, frankly, the slowness sometimes of how long it takes to validate things and really make this happen at scale, that's looking like it perhaps might not be so efficient either. So all of these things are currently being worked out and discussed.
How does the number of transactions per second possible with something like Bitcoin compare with the numbers processed by a company like Visa, which operates all over the globe?
Right. So I'm blanking on the exact numbers here, but it's not even close. You know, Visa is able to process far more transactions than the cryptocurrency networks such as Bitcoin. Now, certain cryptocurrencies are working on this problem, and they are tweaking the blockchain that Bitcoin used, and they are making new sorts of blockchains that attempt to deal with this problem. But right now, certainly the speed at which things can get done is a barrier to really this growing at scale.
So I know that we're not exactly close to perfecting quantum computing, but the thought is that once we do, there will be no unbreakable code. Would the limitless capacity of something like quantum computing enable blockchain and digital currencies, or would it endanger them? Would they still be impervious to hacking if we had quantum computers working for us?
Yeah, that's such a fascinating thing to think about right now. So quantum computing would probably do a bit of both. You know, it would allow, it could help tackle the energy problem of distributed ledgers, because you would be able to solve these mathematical problems at just a completely different rate. It wouldn't take all of the computing power that we use now. But of course, yes, we would be able to, infiltrate these networks if the way that it's secure is based on, for example, a public key and a private key, and it's basically alphanumeric, code, and quantum computing would be able to, the speed and power would be able to hack, if you will, into those systems. So it's very true that anything being built on blockchain technology right now could in the future at some point not be secure. And so whenever we have a new technology that's very shiny and exciting, anyone who says that something is unhackable, that's a poor way to think about it. Maybe it's unhackable now, but will it be unhackable 20, 30, 50 years from now? So if you're putting these permanent things, onto a blockchain, what could happen to that data in the future if we have something like quantum computing?
One concern with this new way of dealing with sensitive information, with money, transactions based on blockchain, is that only a small percentage of financial services professionals who are active right now say they fully understand it. No disrespect to them, because I certainly don't fully understand it, but how well do folks in the finance industry need to understand blockchain in order to be ready for this new element of the financial system?
I think in some, you know, in some senses, it depends where in finance you work. It's certainly, I think the number that we had was that according to a survey that PricewaterhouseCoopers did, 77% of the global financial services industry is expected to adopt blockchain as part of a production system or, you know, a process by 2020, which is just around the corner. So that's like a pretty high number. So there's always been, you know, a niche group that's been looking into this for the past, you know, 5-10 years as blockchain technology has emerged. But I certainly think there is more of an interest now, and there's a real rush from the academic side and, you know, really to understand this at a much better level and to understand how it intersects with policy and law and human behavior, not just the computer science and not just the code, but really, the interplay of all of these different fields.
We're talking about blockchain and digital currency with Jen Schwartz of Scientific American Magazine. Her magazine has a special report this month called The Future of Money. I want to jump over to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. First question comes from Matt in Dallas. Hi, Matt.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a question about the rise of Ripple. I'm hearing a lot about this cryptocurrency called Ripple, and hearing some people speculate that once it reaches $7, it'll be in the same playing field as Bitcoin. And I'm kind of wondering, what are your thoughts on the rise of this Ripple cryptocurrency, and how will it affect the cryptocurrency playing field?
Thanks for your call, Matt. There are a lot of potential rivals out there trying to get started.
Yes. So I would like to start by saying that I am a journalist and not a financial strategist by any stretch. But based on what I've observed, Bitcoin was the first, and Bitcoin ushered in blockchain technology. Now, of course, we're seeing all these other types of cryptocurrencies, and not just Ripple and Ethereum Litecoin and all of these others that people are hearing about on a day-to-day basis in the news, but, thousands more, and new ones are emerging all the time. What's interesting is that I think over, you know, the next year or whatever it'll be, you'll see other cryptocurrencies sort of rising to power in terms of how they are having an effect on this cryptocurrency ecosystem. But I think it'll be interesting to see how they start to solve for some of the problems that Bitcoin has, sort of brought into public consciousness. So Ripple is different from Bitcoin in that it has a different validation process. There are just different ways that the blockchain is essentially designed. So, you know, I personally do not have any thoughts in terms of, from the financial side, which one is better than the other. I think that's really like this day-to-day watching them rise, watching interest in them, watching how it'll shake out. But I think what will be interesting long-term from the technological perspective is, are any of these cryptocurrencies going to sort of evolve to become true alternative currencies? Might any of them really try to be a currency that ordinary people can use for day-to-day transactions? Might we one day have a cryptocurrency that could compete with our, you know, major reserve currencies? So I think sort of taking the long game and maybe not looking at it so much of, you know, which one is worth more and which one is dropped and that sort of jockeying in the short term. But I'm interested as a journalist looking at this world of, in the longer term, will we have true alternatives in cryptocurrencies? And will they start to solve the problems, not just, you know, as a speculative investment, but really in day-to-day use?
So some folks at MIT who are working on a potential competitor called Tradecoin note that the biggest difference in what they're doing is that Tradecoin would be backed by real assets. And that's something that doesn't exist with Bitcoin.
That's right. So Bitcoin, you really have to think of it as it's not backed by anything. It's backed by code. And it's fascinating, and the technology is impressive. And from an ideological standpoint, Bitcoin is really interesting. And I think it has certainly the allure of that of, oh, if someone doesn't trust, you know, traditional banks and governments, that Bitcoin would look very appealing. But there are obviously problems with it. So one of the stories, one of the features in our special report looks at how academia and, you know, these computer scientists and quants from the traditional world of finance are looking at how other cryptocurrencies could perhaps solve for some of the issues that we're seeing. So the MIT researchers discuss Tradecoin, which isn't out yet. It's, you know, they're still working on it. But the idea is that what if it was backed by, you know, a basket of assets, and it was managed not by this truly distributed public network, but alliances of small merchants? You know, what if you had a global group of farmers get together and have their version of a trade coin? It would allow you to sort of participate in global trade and give you more security and freedom to do so. And so that's one area where perhaps these cryptocurrencies could start to give sort of the little guys more autonomy and power while still protecting them against, you know, some of the issues with global trade.
So help me understand this, because one reason people think that alternative currencies, these digital currencies that are based on blockchain, would be better than currencies created by central banks is that central banks are self-interested, right? They're going to protect sort of the biggest players within the country in which they operate. But there is a scenario by which these central banks could actually have more control over these currencies than over the ones that they already control. Can you help me understand that?
Sure. So that's one of the possibilities that we bring up in our coverage, is that if blockchain technology can be used by anyone, then, you know, theoretically, you could have a central bank decide to put all of the national currency onto blockchain technology. And there are countries that are researching this now. And so what you would see in that scenario is that if all of our money, if, like, you know, hypothetically, let's say all of the US dollar was operating on blockchain, that would mean that every purchase, every transaction that you make would be permanently recorded in the blockchain by our central bank, by this, you know, by the government. And so it introduces the specter of higher level of surveillance. And that's where things get a little creepy for people. And so you start to see how this technology can be used for a lot of decentralization of, you know, human emancipation from these big, powerful structures. But it can be also used to truly centralize control and power. So that's why it's important to realize that when you hear the word blockchain, it can really be used for anything. And we don't know how it will be used in the future.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go back to the phones now. Rusty is calling us from Fort Worth. Hi, Rusty.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two things. One is, I'm still not certain what gives Bitcoin its value. I mean, I know that behind the dollar, there's some perceived value. And the second question is, if I were being paid in Bitcoin, if I were being paid one Bitcoin a year in annual salary, my annual salary went from $30,000 to $16,000 overnight. So where is the stability in this currency?
Yeah, right. So let me answer the first question about value. Everyone asks this question, and, you know, it's a critical question. Where does the value come from? And if some people argue that Bitcoin has no value, and that's why it can have any price. It could be worth $1 million one Bitcoin, or it could be worth $0. And when there's no value, the price is totally volatile. Some people argue that the value of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies comes from our, you know, collective belief that it has value. Some talk, you know, it comes from consensus and faith. And if, you know, if some people say, if you really back up, where where does the value of the dollar come from? Isn't it also based on the fact that we all agree it has a certain value? Of course, like you said, there is a lot of policy and law in place, in addition to a lot of traditional structures that we already all agree upon. So it is very tricky to say what the value is if we don't exactly have a defined way to describe it. So that is up for debate for sure. And it's true. How can Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies truly be useful if we have no idea what the price will be next week, let alone, 10, 20 years from now? Certainly it's not useful, to put your get paid in Bitcoin or, put your savings into Bitcoin, because there's no way to know what it will become. And that's why it's looking, certainly more like a social experiment and this sort of speculative, crazy and fascinating, but not exactly secure place to put your money. That's for sure.
Well, and it's really ironic because you have this thing that is supposed to be this, radical alternative to all the other currency systems we have, and yet the only way we can even begin to measure its value is by pegging it to the other established currencies that we already use.
Right. And so the idea is that if cryptocurrencies end up being a better way to track information, track money, track, exchange than our current systems, then, you have this idea that there is some secured value in, if we could figure that out, if this becomes a more efficient system, you could have the value kind of unto itself would start to emerge. Of course, that would require, everything to stabilize. And right now, we're just not seeing that. And I think the fact that we don't have regulation and we have this proliferation of cryptocurrencies and of all the applications that we need to use them, exchanges and digital wallets, all of this is unregulated. And there are plenty of people out there who are trying to exploit the system. And so it really is quite risky right now.
And losing a password is tantamount to, dropping hundreds of dollars into a fire, right? It's just gone.
Right. I mean, there's no help desk for a lot of this stuff. And so if you just decide one day you're going to buy some Bitcoin, but you don't really understand how the network functions and you don't understand where the little vulnerable layers are and what you have to put in place to make sure you're secure, it can start to get pretty dicey. And even in the best case scenarios, this is an emerging world and certain things go offline or have a crisis and you really just don't know where things will go.
Jen Schwartz is my guest. She's senior features editor at Scientific American, which has a January issue that features a special report on the future of money. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. You can call 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jen Schwartz, senior features editor at Scientific American, which in its January issue has a report on the future of money. It talks a lot about digital currencies and blockchain, which is the technology on which many of them are based. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Bill in Dallas, who writes, "What kind of plan is in place to deal with the loss of the power grid, or if someone does figure out how to hack the blockchain system? Is there a plan for that, Jen?"
So this comes up a lot of, basically blockchain, the Bitcoin blockchain, if we just use that as an example, it runs on the internet, if you will. So it's not exactly it's not a single website. You know, it's not, and that's the idea, is that if it's distributed and it's this sort of globally distributed network, then it's less vulnerable to if you have a blackout in, say, one city or one country. You know, it would really take, I suppose, the whole internet crashing to really lose all of the Bitcoin network. Of course, if that happens, we have lots of other problems of equal
right.
weight. And so, you know, there are certainly concerns and about what it means that all of this exists in what is effectively zeros and ones, and that there isn't, you know, it's not backed by anything and it's not backed by tangible assets. And that's very, you know, scary and strange for a lot of people. But again, I think what makes it even more, you know, volatile right now is that there really is just no value to any of it, and that the price is all over the place. So, you know, it's true that in the future, when we think about what are the potential issues of storing all of our currency on a network that runs on, you know, the internet, what are the possible ways it could be attacked? Of course, you know, I think that does introduce the specter of a weakness, but it also means that a lot of other problems would arise if we get to that point.
How will we decide what security matters are valuable enough to spirit away, hide away using blockchain? You know what I'm saying?
So do you mean what sort of compromises?
No, what I mean is, you know, it sounds like blockchain is pretty expensive to generate, and therefore do we have to be really selective about, you know, maybe we put our bank accounts behind blockchain security, but maybe we don't need that for, you know, the records every time we go to the doctor's office, that sort of thing.
Sure. Okay, great question. Right now, you're seeing that a lot of companies, you know, are attaching blockchain to their name. They're saying, we're going to put this system instead of our current ledger, our current way to track data, we are going to use a blockchain. You know, that's a real buzzword right now. And I think there's a lot of, you know, whatever people think of it, whether it means more trust or whether it means, you know, the bleeding edge of technology and where things are going. But you're absolutely right. There is a conversation right now and of looking into where is blockchain most efficient? Where is it most useful? And I think it'll shake out of where it makes sense to apply it and where it doesn't make sense, where it really is just a fancier way, you know, that's more energy intensive to keep track of data than what we already have. So, you know, again, right now there's this experimentation going on. And as, you know, programmers and software engineers sort of design these new ideas, these new applications of how blockchain can be used, we're starting to see where it's efficient and where it's not efficient, where it can scale and where it can't. And so I do think that finance will be a place where that happens. You know, we mentioned in the package that looking at medical data, your medical records, you know, places where right now we have a very frustrating, you know, level of bureaucracy and it's messy and it's convoluted. Is there a way that blockchain could make that just more efficient? That's what we're looking into now. But, you know, you're also seeing blockchain being used for all sorts of things, you know, that might seem a little more you know, sort of everyday or almost a little more flippant, if you will, like, you know, trading, you know, solar energy from, you know, your home to someone else's home, or tracking, you know, the provenance of fine wine or intellectual property for music. And so, you know, will some of these things see that blockchain is a much better way to do it? Perhaps. But, you know, I think just because a company is adopting blockchain does not mean that it is a better process going forward and that it'll work at scale.
Is blockchain an infinite resource, presuming that we continue to sort of create more chains to add to the block?
So,
or blocks to add to the chain?
Yes. Each blockchain is its own network.
Okay.
So there isn't like one big blockchain. Every time you have a new network, it's a new blockchain. So Ripple has its own blockchain. Bitcoin has its own blockchain. You know, my previous example of, you know, using solar power and exchanging, you know, your extra energy with your neighbor, that's its own blockchain. So the idea is that, you know, it starts to take up, all these things start to take up space, right? You know, so if you can imagine a future in which we have so many different networks existing on blockchain, and we haven't figured out how to deal with the energy problem to maintain them, you can start to see a ceiling when this becomes just too energy intensive, and really when it starts to just slow down because there's just too much going on. Of course, that's really projecting into the future of what will we have in the future to, you know, change computing power. Like you mentioned earlier, how will potentially quantum computing change all of this? So it really remains to be seen.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Chad is calling us from Arlington. Hi, Chad.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to first say that there's a lot of smart minds addressing all of these concerns regarding blockchain, like the problems and issues that that are arising. But I would like to get your guest to speak on, earlier she mentioned how energy intensive it is to mine blocks. I'd like to get her to speak on Ethereum's solution to that, the proof-of-stake model.
You broke up a little bit. Ethereum, can you repeat the last part of that sentence, please?
Oh, yeah. I'd just like to get your guest to speak on Ethereum's solution to the energy intensive intensity to mine blocks, the Ethereum's proof-of-stake model.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So, right. So if we can go back to Bitcoin for a second, they use proof of work. So again, that's based on having a large distributed global network of strangers operating computers to validate the network. So the more computers you have, the bigger the network grows, the more energy you need. So if the Ethereum network looked at that and said, how can we address that problem? Well, so proof of stake essentially in its simple form means that instead of having a large distributed public network of validators, you have a sort of pre-authenticated smaller network of trusted validators. And again, this is just one example, but the idea is that you the network already has a smaller group in place, and there is a different incentive structure to validate and maintain the network. Therefore, it uses less energy because when it grows, you don't necessarily have the same growth of needing all this computing power to wrangle the whole thing. But what people need to remember is when you re-centralize a network like that, you are bringing in, again, centralized control to some extent. You are saying there will be some, you know, whoever invests in it more heavily has more control over the network. So, you know, it brings up what's important to remember is it doesn't necessarily have the same ideology as Bitcoin, which is, you know, sort of pushing back against the intermediaries and the power players. When you have proof of stake, it now becomes a little more privatized. It's called a permissioned ledger sometimes. And the idea is that you are, you're okay with some centralized control. You're okay with the intermediary being there to operate it because you have less energy being used and because it also sort of brings the network, makes it a little more secure and adds levels of sometimes identity and makes things a little more clear if you need a more trusted system.
We're talking about the future of money with Scientific American senior features editor Jen Schwartz. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm curious, Jen, I don't know how often you've asked the question, but are people working to perfect and refine blockchain technology likely to speculate at all in digital currency? Do they have any of their own money in this digital currency game?
That's a great question, too. You know, one of the things that's come up recently, and again, there are lots of brilliant minds across all different sectors and fields and that are looking into all of these issues. you know, it's true that if you are invested in cryptocurrencies, naturally you want them to succeed. And so if you're, you know, giving out advice or information, you know, you're potentially or you are biased because you have every you want them to succeed. And, you know, you might perhaps be less likely to mention how they might fail, what the peril might be, where all the weaknesses and issues are. So I think just having observed this as a journalist, I think the important thing for the public to keep in mind, and anyone who's interested in following this, is make sure you're sort of getting a fuller picture of what people think. There's a lot of skeptics. There's a lot of people who are bearish on where the technology is going, if it will truly be useful, the concerns that we should be looking into about identity and security and really just economic stability with all of this. There are a lot of issues and smart people looking into it. So, right now the day-to-day coverage is very much based on Bitcoin, and now Ripple has more, market share or is growing in that direction. And so the conversation day-to-day is very fixated on the cryptocurrency level and which one is doing better than the other. But really, it's wise for all of us to zoom out and look at the bigger picture of where the issues are and who is really solving for some of those things.
A little sidebar in the package of articles insists we are not anywhere near close to the demise of cash. Why does cash remain relevant?
Well, on a purely practical level, cash is really relevant for a lot of people around the world. We have this technology, this blockchain technology, and we're talking about all the ways it could possibly change things. But if you look at who is really using it and transacting with it, it is still a very niche way to do things. And so cash, is probably not going anywhere because it's a quick way to exchange money. And if you are not banked, there are plenty of people globally who are not banked, who are not don't have a credit card, who do not have a checking account. And so cash, and sometimes really just, there are amounts of cash that get exchanged. And it's just more useful to do that. And of course, you can't track cash. It's just paper. It's really the original peer-to-peer, right? You hand it off from one person to the next. Cash isn't going anywhere anytime soon. And again, everyone has to remember that Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are, in terms of usefulness, are in their infancy. There are very few people really using it as their primary source of currency, unless the one example I give is if you look at countries where there is hyperinflation, such as Venezuela or Zimbabwe, where their national currency, is incredibly risky, and your income might have half of the value in the future. So people are saying, well, I'm just going to put my money into Bitcoin, and a lot of markets, just grocery stores and car dealerships are accepting it because more and more people are using it. So even though Bitcoin is very risky and volatile, some people are deciding it's less risky than perhaps a hyperinflating currency, that's what is happening in their country. So that's one place where people are truly using it on a day-to-day basis.
So it sounds like for now, at least, there's no reason to believe that the value of blockchain-based currency will stabilize and sort of stay predictable.
I don't foresee how that's going to happen anytime soon because it is in such a state of flux. And it's not just the individual currencies themselves, but the sort of collection and aggregation of all the different types of currencies that are emerging, and how the public perceives them, how regulation starts getting their hands around all of this, how traditional banking structures starts operating with it or operating with the technology. So again, until there are cryptocurrencies that start to look at balancing and stabilizing the value, I don't know. No one really knows where anything is going in the near future in terms of stable prices.
Jen Schwartz is senior features editor at Scientific American. You can find The Future of Money in the January issue. Jen, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director with Eric Bright on the board today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.